Hello and welcome to the BFBS podcast, Mav Geeks, a military aircraft obsession with me, Jamie Gordon.
And me, Ginny Carlin. If this is your first time listening, let's just make sure that you're in the right place. Now, do you love military aircraft? Tick. Are you obsessed with aviation as a whole? Tick, tick. And are you ready to listen to two enthusiastic loons speak to the absolute experts in their field about all things, well, Mav Geek? Tick, tick, and tick.
So I'm over in Sheffield and Ginny is way over there at the British Army training camp in Suffield in Alberta, Canada. And how's your week been?
Well, in Canada, Jamie, everything is changing. The weather is changing. It's got a little bit colder. So it's a nice autumny or fall kind of a nip in the air. So we are heading into winter, which means, of course, that air show season is over. One big thing, I think, in the aviation week that's happened this last week has been, you know, we were talking about the KC-10 extender in our first episode of this series.
Yeah.
Well, it finally came to pass. The final KC extender flew from Travis Air Force Base out to the Boneyard. And I watched it. I watched it online. They had a big ceremony at Travis Air Force Base to say goodbye. Lots and lots of people there. It was like a very somber military occasion. You know, the KC-10 was there. All the people sat round, people doing speeches and stuff. And then she flew out and flew to, well, a final resting place, really. Lots of people online getting very excited and like, oh, can we not use her again? But can we not sell her to, you know, somebody else who's going to do tanking? The bottom line is these aircraft are really, really old. And I'm pretty sure that if the American Air Force had kept them, they'd probably have injected more life into them. But yeah, it was just a sad day to say goodbye to a legend, the big, sexy, what a plane.
There were loads and loads of social media posts. I've been following those as well. So it really was, if you can be emotional about a lump of aluminium, then I think, yeah, it was. And I mean, I'm guessing it's some kind of financial decision that somebody has to make. Yes, they've got a certain amount of flight hours that they can have in their lifetime. But, you know, look at the B-52. That's upgraded and upgraded and upgraded and will be serving for a good 100 years at very least. But they've got a replacement for the KC-10 in the KC-46, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Based on the old 767 frame. And I suppose the other thing is, there's a lot of people saying, well, why is the KC-135 still flying? It sort of did the same job, really. I mean, that is on a 707 frame, and that's even older.
I know. It's, a difficult decision. And the Boneyard is somewhere we should talk about at some point in this series, because it really is an extraordinary place. Just, you know, look, just going Google it, and if you've got any interest in airplanes at all, it's a bit sad because it is a cemetery for, you know, ex-military aircraft, but it is quite a sight.
Oh my gosh, honestly, take me there, Jamie, just leave me there, I'll be fine.
Anyway, let's get on with this week's episode. The Red Arrows are celebrating their 60th anniversary, and they've been in Toronto celebrating Maple Hawk 2024, so it's been a big year for them, hasn't it?
Absolutely massive year. They saw them at Riyadh, as I was sort of saying in that first episode, where they flew alongside the CF-18's Hornets of the Royal Canadian Air Force, and then went back over there for, like you say, Maple Hawk 2024, and just have done air show after air show after air show. The Canadians really taking them to the heart. What an absolute fantastic year for them. But also, we got the fantastic opportunity to speak to former officer commanding 617 Squadron, that's Wing Commander Stu Campbell, who was with the F-35s. I mean, this is a bit of a story. Stay with us. Was with the F-35s out in Iceland. But he was telling us a little bit about his time with the Reds and what it really meant to put on that red suit.
Well, I'm very pleased to say that joining us on this edition of Mav Geeks is the OC 617 Squadron Wing Commander Stu Campbell, who, as you will know, is in charge of a squadron of F-35Bs. For the first time, the UK has deployed on a NATO policing mission with these aircraft, and I'm delighted to say that Stu joins us from Iceland. Stu, first of all, why was this aircraft chosen for this particular deployment at this particular time?
Jamie, well, I think ultimately it was our turn. Typhoon have been doing native air policing for quite some time now, before that, Tornado F3s. And we've been operating F35 in the UK for around about 6 years now. So it really was about time that we stepped up to the plate and tried it. And indeed, as you said, this is the first time we've done it from land. We have done alert or effectively QRA from the aircraft carrier before. So it was a chance for us to come up. Sure, commitment to NATO in a time of kind of heightened readiness across Europe, putting fifth generation fighters forward and demonstrating our ability to do QRA.
Stu, it must be so different flying in Icelandic airspace than it is in the UK. You know, like Jamie was saying to me earlier, just imagine like the volcano. You don't even think of volcanoes in the UK at all, but land of fire and ice and volcanoes. What are the idiosyncrasies of flying in that airspace?
In some ways, airspace is fantastic in that it's very open. The UK's got a huge amount of airliners crisscrossing it all the time. There's a lot of traffic here going between North America, Canada, and across towards Europe. But really, that's in quite tight lanes. So outside that, we're definitely finding the airspace quite quiet and able to really enjoy some of the fantastic scenery. As you said, we touched on the volcanoes. They're quite spectacular. Some of the glaciers and the really rugged coastline all the way around. Stunning.
Now, Stu, we know that you're there. It's NATO's, it's the first NATO policing deployment of the F-35B. But day to day for the layman, what does the job actually entail? Like, what kind of things will you be doing daily?
So we are effectively putting a number of jets on an alert, and I'm waiting for the buzzer to go. So a little bit like, I guess, somebody working in a fire station, or perhaps paramedics, etc. So we have a number of engineers and a number of air crew holding a buzzer. And outside of flying, then we go about our daily business. So whether that for me, for my sins, I have a lot of staff work and typing to do. For some of the younger people, they luckily get to go and enjoy the gym a little bit more, or perhaps on periods of decreased alert, perhaps get to go and explore the island a little bit and integrate with the Icelandic people.
And so on a similar theme, what kind of a liaison do you have with the Icelandic authorities there? Because they don't really have a defence force as such. The Coast Guard does a lot of that work. So do you liaise with them at all?
Yeah, very much so. So we're based at Keflavik International Airport, and at the far end of that is a military or as you say, Coast Guard kind of controlled zone. So we're very close to the people who run that. The base commander, John, has become a close colleague, gusting on friend, I'm sure, by the end of the deployment. And John and his team have just been absolutely fantastic at doing everything they can to enable us to carry out this mission.
Now, Stu, it's a huge area that you're going to be working in. Who is backing you up there? Who's doing the tanking and the search and rescue?
So for the search and rescue, we've got the Icelandic Coast Guard. So we have two helicopters here on standby, just like we would have in the UK. But unlike in the UK, I guess, they're co-located with us. So I can pretty much see them out the window as I turn around just now. And we brief with these people every day and know that we're going to be rescued. From an air-to-air refueling point of view, we have support from the UK Voyager Force, as we do again back home.
Let's talk about the F-35 itself. How well does it suit this role in a general sense?
Yeah, so the F-35, as most people know, comes in three different versions, the A model, the B and the C, and the UK currently operate the B model, so short takeoff, vertical landing, and we bought that because of our commitment to carrier strike. However, the jet can be operated just like an A model can, and although the F-35B hasn't done QRA before, or certainly the UK ones haven't, the A models are holding QRA in Norway, they're holding it in Alaska, is very much a daily role for some F-35s. We're just dipping our toe in the water, really, making sure that we can do it if we need to. We don't have that many aircraft yet compared to the likes of America. So I'm sure as our numbers grow and perhaps in the future Typhoon numbers go down, you might end up seeing F-35s doing Cura in the UK, but that certainly won't be in the next decade.
Now, Stu, you've obviously flown a number of aircraft, and it must be mind-blowing to see the advancement of technologies through all of them, from when you started to where you are now with the F-35. But which one have you enjoyed flying the most?
So from a pure piloting point of view, actually the Hawk. So I've got over 1,000 hours flying Hawk, and a lot of that with the Red Arrows. And from a raw piloting point of view, it's just a fantastic aeroplane. It's a little classic sports car, kind of like a Lotus Elise, I guess. From a warfighting capability, nothing touches F-35. However, to sit in it and to fly it can be a little bit bland from a raw piloting point of view. They all tend to handle the same. I fly it an awful lot on the autopilot because it can fly it better than me. I don't, of course, fight it that way, but I operate it domestically quite a lot using that. So I think over my career to go to war in the F-35, I wouldn't look at anything else. But if it was a Friday afternoon and the sun was out, I'd struggle to look past a Hawk.
Yeah, a little bit of analog never does anybody any harm, does it?
Absolutely.
You know, you must get asked this a lot, Stu, with the legacy of 617 Squadron, but do you feel the weight of that legacy, but in a good way, on your shoulders a little bit?
Yeah, hugely. I mean, I'm so incredibly proud to, well, I've always been proud to be a member of 617 Squadron, let alone being the boss of it. I was fairly fortunate in my career that I've only really been on 617 Squadron in the Dambuster, and sorry, in the Red Arrows. So my first tour on the front line was Tornado, and that was on 617 Squadron. I had just over 3 years that time. And then this time around has been about 5.5 years where I've either been the XO, so second in command, and then for the last 2 years been the boss. And yeah, without a doubt, when I walk in every day and see that picture of the squadron back in 1943 with Guy Gibson sat in the middle, it can be quite daunting.
But once a Red Arrow, always a Red Arrow, and it's a big year for them as well.
Huge year for the Reds, yeah, 60th anniversary. I actually joined the team for their 50th anniversary, so it's making me feel even blooming older looking at those guys, you know, off to celebrate 60 years. And yeah, I'm sure they'll do just as good a job as we did back in 2014.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to seeing them over here in Canada in the next month or so, doing lots and lots of air shows, but obviously... unfortunately, not too close to British Army Training Unit Suffield here in Alberta.
Oh, that's a shame. I mean, luckily, there's hopefully plenty on YouTube and X and all those kind of things for them to be able to watch.
I was going to ask you, Stu, about have you died of shock yet of the how much a pint is in Iceland?
Oh, it's bloody horrendous. Yeah. Yeah. We've found one place where I think we can just get under £6, which is unheard of. The rest of the places are, you know, the best part of 10.
And has anybody tried Rotten Shark yet?
No Rotten Shark yet, as far as I know. I think we've tried the shot that's meant to go with it, but avoided the Rotten Shark.
Brilliant. Wing Commander Stu Campbell, OC of 617 Squadron, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So that was Wing Commander Stu Campbell, who, when we spoke to him, was in charge of 617 Squadron. He's now handed that over to a Royal Marine, would you believe, which I think, I don't know if that's a first or not, but it's certainly quirky. And in fact, the 617 Squadron were actually deployed to Iceland for the first time in a NATO policing role. So it really was an auspicious occasion for them. Now, later on, we managed to catch up with two of the Red Arrows whilst they were still in Canada. That's Red 6, Flight Lieutenant Stuart Roberts, and Red 9, Flight Lieutenant Patrick Paddy Kershaw, to discuss the 60th anniversary celebrations for the Red Arrows and the privilege that it is to don the red suit and how they've been making the last of their 3 years of service count. Right. Well, it's like buses, you know. You get two Red Arrows at once. Thank you very much for joining us. First of all, could you just tell us about your individual ways into the RAF, because Patrick, I think you were doing business, weren't you, Leicester?
I went to university, was doing a business degree, and when I was at uni, I joined the University Air Squadron, and I started learning to fly. I was actually on the Air Squadron with John Bond, who's the team leader, so we were on the same one together, And yeah, I started learning to fly there, and then I decided to apply for an IAF bursary in my final year, and I was lucky enough to get a pilot scholarship for the Air Force, and then a kind of guaranteed slot after that. And then joined the Air Force in 2006, was commissioned as an officer in 2007, and then selected for fast jet training after that. And I went on to fly the Tornado as instructor on the Hawk. Actually, my first instructional sortie on the Hawk was teaching Stu Roberts, who sat next to me. he was just about to finish flying training at the time. And then I also flew the Typhoon as well. And again, worked with Stu on Typhoon and Dusty and plenty of the guys on the team who were playing Typhoon and Tornado as well. We've all kind of worked together.
Slightly different routing in some ways. I grew up in the Air Force, so my dad was in for about 25 years. So I did a lot of moving around with the Air Force, was kind of exposed to it quite a lot growing up. And then I went to university. I did geography at Loughborough, and I got to the end of my kind of time and started looking at the careers fairs. And I'd seen some of the more challenging sides of the Air Force, moving around as a family and all that kind of stuff. But I'd always been fascinated by aviation and aeroplanes. And then that was where I ended up jumping ship and looking at all the other things that the Air Force could bring, travel, flying, some of the excitement that came with that. And being a geography teacher didn't really appeal. So I went off and applied that way. I was a couple of years behind behind Paddy. So I joined in about 2009. And then, yeah, we ended up, we've crossed paths. It's quite a small world, really. But yeah, I was Paddy's first proper student as an instructor. And then I ended up on Typhoon ahead of him. We ended up on the same squadron at 11 Squadron at Coningsby. And then we actually worked together again on 12 Squadron on Typhoon, teaching Qatari students how to operate the aircraft. So yeah, relatively small world.
Excellent. Now, I mean, the word iconic is used quite a bit with the Red Arrows. I just got to ask you, how easy is it to go from flying on a squadron from Typhoons to then being in that red suit? I mean, is it like one day you wake up and you've got an email saying, you know, do you want to join us, or are you having to throw your hat in the ring to be considered?
You can start applying lessons as soon as you become a fast jet pilot, but you probably won't be considered. So there's kind of criteria you need. So you need to have done a frontline tour, have 1,500 flying hours and be assessed as above average. So we get, there's an annual report written on each of us, kind of gives us an assessment of our ability. So those reports then will go to the Reds when you apply. I started applying in about 2015, kind of didn't really have the criteria at the time, but I just wanted to start applying. And then I managed to get kind of my first attempt at selection in 2019. Didn't get in, but then reapplied in 2021 when the selection reopened post-COVID. And that was on the same one as Stu. And yeah, thankfully kind of got in that time. And then when you get in, you kind of obviously convert back to the Hawk, and it's then a long process of kind of winter training to go from just kind of basic kind of formation flying to the advanced formation flying that we do on the team as well. So it's a long workup and lots of hard work, but we still do formation on the front line. So we do it on Typhoon, Tornado. The guys get taught it when you go through training at kind of every stage as well. So it's not something that's totally new, but the way the team does it is slightly different to how kind of normal conventional formation planning is done. And clearly there's a lot more aircraft involved as well. So yeah, it takes time and a bit of hard work, but it's pretty good when you get to the end of the kind of the process and you start to wear the red suit and go around the UK, around the world, straight off the team.
Are you a particular type of pilot, so I'll put this to Stu, that wants to be in the Red Arrows, or, you know, because some guys aren't and probably don't fancy it? Is that the case?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's not for everybody. I think there's time away. The type of flying, I think most people would enjoy getting to do as much flying as we get to do. That's what everybody joined up to do. That's what everybody wants to do. But certainly some of this sort of stuff, the PR side of it, the meeting the public, being out and about at the weekends, signing autographs and things, which is great, but it's not for everybody for sure. And I think the selection process kind of makes that clear to people as well, and they get a little bit of exposure to that. We try to take people when they come out to Greece for a week. We try to take them to a function. The embassy are normally very good at helping us out with that. They'll set something up to bring people along, and you can kind of drop them in. We've been doing a lot of it on this tour. We've been looked after very well by the UK and Canada and the embassies and the consulates. And sorry, it's not embassies, is it? The consulates and the high commissions. And they've been really good. But you do get dropped into random rooms full of people that you kind of have to mingle with and go and chat to. It's definitely not for everybody.
Excellent. Now, let's just, you guys are joining us from Montreal in Canada. I'm down here at Batis, which is just south of Calgary. We're quite a few miles apart, but it's. I've just seen all over the Canadian press, all over the UK press. I know that you've been at the air shows commemorating the Royal Canadian Air Force's centennial year, your 60th year as well. First of all, I need to ask, have you both just had your fill of poutine?
You had some the other week, didn't you, when we were out for dinner? I haven't had any.
I felt like I couldn't pass it up. Yeah. We have tried it. Everyone's had a dig in, and they've all everyone's had a little go, and a beaver tail as well.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I was just going to ask about a beaver tail. Yeah, absolutely, just amazing. And also, I mean, I find the Canadians to be the nicest people in the world, to the point that sometimes I think they're being sarcastic because they're so nice. Have you found that amazing Canadian hospitality?
Yeah, definitely. Everyone's been really friendly and welcoming since we've been here. So it's made it, really enjoyable and made us feel at home as well, which is good.
And just to say, I was at REACT this year where I saw you displaying with Tango from the CF-18 Hornet display team. That was breathtaking. That for me was probably, apart from seeing the KC-10, which I am a complete nerd on, that was probably the highlight of REACT for me, seeing you fly with Tango. How was that, and what's the kind of feedback that you got from that?
We've been pretty lucky to replicate that a whole bunch of times out here as well. So the shows that we've been at, from Greenwood down through Ottawa, Gatineau, Toronto, and then London, the same people have been there. So we've had Tango with the CF-18, the Snowbirds have been at all of them.
Wow.
We managed to do a couple of mixed formation trips with the Snowbirds. We did one off the lakefront of Toronto. We did pass over Ottawa for the opening of the High Commission. And then pretty much every air show, we've managed to team up with Tango again. And they've dubbed it the Commonwealth Pass here. So with Tango. So we're pretty slick at it now. But the first couple of times, especially for REACT, there's a lot of approvals that have to go into it. A bit of coordination and planning. He's always really short on fuel at the end of the demo. So there's a bit of pressure on us to get airborne, get together, get him joined up, and then back on the deck as quick as possible.
Just really quickly, from a purely aesthetic point of view, I think that the two aircraft together just look really good, really good.
It was really cool. It was great having him in the formation with us, and we were able to take him flying as well. So he came flying with me in my jet in one of our practice displays at Gatineau. So that was really good to kind of say thanks for do the formation stuff with us as well.
And you mentioned you flew with the Snowbirds. I mean, it looked fantastic. It's probably one of the most scenic countries in the world. So the flying must be very picturesque.
Yeah, it's really good. Really looking like the Toronto Air Show. It's able to do kind of a display literally next to the CN Tower. And that skyline was incredible. Yeah, it's a really, really kind of privilege to do it. And then the different kind of landscape as well. So you're arriving kind of in Greenwood, big open areas there, and then flying down to Toronto from there as well. So, yeah, really privileged, and we've had some great views.
I think we've all been blown away by the scale of the country.
And
there's some beautiful bits, but there's huge amounts of wilderness, essentially. Yeah. We landed into Goose Bay, having completed the transit across, and then went down to Greenwood, but I think we must have covered about 300 miles of nothing.
Yeah.
And not a human being, a human object anywhere. So it's been quite interesting, kind of the logistics side of it, and getting the jets and people around this side of the country. Been quite something.
Yeah, you talk about that wilderness, that's where I live. Trust me, it's 40 miles to the nearest Walmart. You kind of alluded to this, I think, at the beginning of our chat about, being in the Red Arrows is not for everybody. You spend a lot of time from home, away from home. You are a long way from home here. You have been here for quite a while. Do you ever get to that point where you're just like, I just want to go and have a cup of tea and put my slippers on? Or is it just massively exciting? Does the excitement outweigh everything else?
No, Paddy loves his slippers. go on.
Yeah, no, you do, I think, with everything. So we obviously spend a lot of time together, which is kind of why the process of when we recruit people is really important as well, because we're pretty much, winter training, we're obviously kind of Monday to Friday at Waddington, and obviously people going home then. But from pretty much April until now, we are literally with each other all the time, really.
Yeah.
And so, you definitely do get days where you'll kind of want to take yourself away, and everyone does that, probably times where people decide they're not going to come out for dinner or do something, do their own thing. You know, everyone kind of likes their own company as well, because as a kind of a pilot where you spend maybe 8 hours in a cockpit by yourself, you get used to kind of having your own company. So you can do that as well. But it's nice then when you are away that you've got other people who are in the same situation. It's definitely probably worse for our families back home, because we go away in this adventure with the rest of the team, and we're all together in this adventure together and stuff. And then it's the families back home who are kind of left, you know, with their kind of lives kind of without us there, which is probably harder. So yeah, it's we are, you know, it's good in a way that we've got the company we've got out here. But yeah, it's definitely nice sometimes to be able to just pick feet up and pick slippers on and chill, have a tea or coffee. But yeah, we'll still do that kind of on the road.
We're all missing English breakfast tea, but
oh my gosh,
it's a definite substitute though. I think everyone's become a bit addicted to Timmy Hortons while we've been out here.
Oh my gosh, have you tried the orange pico?
No, not yet.
So how's the 60th anniversary gone? Because has it been a chance to sort of reconnect with the Red Arrows of the past? I mean, obviously there was the get together earlier in the year with Henry Prince. But I mean, how's the whole 60th anniversary gone?
It's been great. We have quite a good relationship with certainly a lot of the team leaders, the ex-team leaders. They come in every year, all the way back to Henry Prince before he sadly passed away earlier this year. But they always come in. The team leaders currently, Bondi did it as well, but talk through their plan with them, talk about how everything's going. They've probably seen it all, done it all, and they definitely bring a different perspective to what we're trying to achieve. They're normally very complimentary about what we're doing, but there's definitely a few things that I know Bondi wanted to bring back when he came back as the boss that they sort of steered him away from potentially, or they went, no, that didn't work for these reasons. But it's been great. We've had the start of the year, we did the fly pass with the Nat, which was brilliant to bring together. So you might have seen some of the imagery with the yellow Nat, which was from the Yellow Jacks. That was actually flown by Ollie Suckling, who's Red 4 this year. So he does some work with that in his spare time. So he was able to fly that, which was quite cool. And then the other bit that Paddy's been involved with is we've been doing the 60. So we had to work up how to draw a 60 in the sky for the show from our perspective. So we've had, you know, mixed results in winter training, but I think we've got it to a pretty consistent standard. But it's Paddy's kind of final piece for the show is to try and draw a six every time we do it.
I was just going to say, I've used the word iconic before. I'd probably use it again before we end the conversation, but do you feel a great weight of responsibility on your shoulders when, I mean, Jamie's just spoken about like the Red Arrows in the past, but what you guys are doing is just something very, very special, and there's people that have gone before you. Do you feel like a responsibility on your shoulders of keeping that heritage going?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a real privilege to kind of put the red suit on, and we're just kind of some people who are just kind of you know, getting to do that for 3-4 years maybe, put the suit on, represent the service and the country and fly those iconic aircraft. And I think we all know that the kind of the famous thing is the aircraft, and we're just kind of the privileged ones who get to fly it. And you'll get people come up to you and say, you know, I saw you in 1994 when you were flying. That I wasn't in the team in 94, but people just see the aircraft, and it's the aircraft that are iconic. And I think it's almost a bit like, you know, there's different people play, say, like Doctor Who or famous roles. We're just able to play this role for 3 years, and then we'll pass it on to someone else, and they'll get to do that role. The role will continue on long after we've left this team, and that's kind of the kind of longevity of it, and the kind of why it's so iconic as well. So it's our last year, so I know next year when you know, the team are doing Flypass of London, I'll be working in London, so my plan is to go and watch that, you know, because ultimately deep down we're all fans of the team as well. That's why we, you know, we're just really lucky fans who get to fly in the team and fly the aircraft. But yeah, it's been a real privilege, and we both don't kind of underestimate that.
I always like those hard-hitting questions that we were asking there, Jamie, like, have you tried the local poutine with the Red Arrows? But so good to speak to them, and so good to, you know, hear what they've been up to. But also, I sometimes forget just how good the Red Arrows are, and I know that from the pictures of them over Toronto, they just did a fantastic job. So really great to speak to those two. Let's go back in time, though. We've had two current Red Arrows. We've had somebody who's been in the Red Arrows not too long ago. But let's go back to the OG Red Arrow, and that is squadron leader Henry Prince. He's very poignant because he passed away earlier on this year at the age of 90. And he was one of the pioneers of the Red Arrows. Let's hear when Forces News spoke to him.
It certainly is nice to know that you were there at the start. We only thought it was going to last, you know, a couple of years or so.
Your son actually showed me a photo of you flying. Can you talk me through what was going on in this photo?
The boys were sitting out on the grass, and I'd just done an air test, and they asked me when I'd done the air test if I'd give them a flyby. So I did. At that point, I'm about 6 feet off the ground. They had to duck out of the way. They've got a great sense of self-preservation, so a lot of them jumped out of the way.
The late squadron leader Henry Prince talking to Forces News back in March, actually, because the current Red Arrows and he got together to mark the official 60th anniversary at RAF Wallington. And, you know, it's worth reflecting on somebody like Henry Prince, because he, along with the legendary Ray Hanna, were basically the two top guys, and they've created what we now know as the Red Arrows in its current form with nine jets. It was their decision to up it to nine jets, and that allowed them to fly the famous Diamond 9 formation. And Henry, one of those pilots who back in the day flew, I'm not going to say by the seat of their pants, but they flew by feel and they flew by touch. There was no fly-by-wire back then. It was proper old yanking the thing about. And he's just got, he was just a lovely man and an absolute legend in my book.
And speaking about legends, if you do have the name, address and number of a aviation legend in your little black book of aviation notes, then please let us know, because we'd love to speak to them. Just get in touch at mavgeeks@bfbs.com. Also, if you want to tune on our pilots playlist at Mavgeeks on Air, it is the same, just mavgeeks@bfbs.com. And speaking about Mavgeeks on Air, you can hear us for an hour from 6 o'clock UK time on a Tuesday, and on a Saturday at 1 o'clock UK time as well on BFBS Radio.
And of course, you can download the podcast wherever you normally get your podcast from. And there's a whole back catalogue there as well to go and explore if you haven't done that already. Next week, we had the opportunity to actually meet in the flesh, me and Ginny, and we went to RAF Coningsby for a proper bit of spotting. We met the old guard, the original spotters that were there in force. And we also grabbed a chat with one of the new generation of spotters. That's Polina, who you can find on TikTok at LifeBroad1. And I suggest you go and check her out. So, see you next time.
Ta-ra!